second from Luke chapter 4, verses 14 to 30. It's in this little sheet here, or it's on the bottom of page 859 in the church Bibles. Verse 14. And Jesus returned in this power of the Spirit to Galilee, and a report about him went out through all the surrounding country. And he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as was his custom, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and he stood up to read. And the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." And all spoke well of him and marveled at the gracious words that were coming from his mouth. And they said, "Is not this Joseph's son?" And he said to them, "Doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, 'Physician, heal yourself. What we have heard you did at Capernaum, do here in your hometown as well.'" And he said, "Truly I say to you, there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heavens were shut up 3 years and 6 months, and a great famine came over all the land. And Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. And there were many lepers in Israel in the time of the prophet Elisha, and none of them was cleansed, but only Naaman the Syrian." When they heard these things, all the synagogue were filled with wrath, and they rose up and drove him out of the town and brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so that they could throw him down the cliff. But passing through their midst, he went away.
Thank you, Betty, and let me add my welcome to Andrew's. And we're continuing our series this autumn, looking through Luke's Gospel. In fact, our plan is to look at Luke's Gospel every autumn until we finish it. So that's going to be, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years or something. But we thought it's a really good idea. It's just lots of people join us who are new to the church, just to and ground ourselves in the teaching of Jesus. I think we did John's Gospel for our first 5 years, and then we finished that. So now we're on to Luke's Gospel for the next 5, 6, 7 years. But we're following it passage by passage. And we get to this famous day when Jesus turns up in the synagogue and reveals his mission statement. So I thought we'd just begin by asking, what should be the mission statement of Grace Church Greenwich? You know, what should we stand for as a church? And it might be that you're new and you were trying to decide what church you would join, and maybe you went to the website, you see a little video there where we set out something of our vision. Maybe you haven't done that much research and someone just invited you and you've come and you don't really know what we stand for. Either way, you're very welcome. I was just trying to think of the places where I've been called upon to sort of define our church or to say what kind of a church we are. And there's two that stick in my mind. One is the Charity Commission ask us, so we're a charity, and the government allows us to get back tax on any money that you want to give to the church, and so we get a bit of a bonus from that. And they ask us to justify that we really are a charity, and they say, "What kind of good do you do?" And you have to, on the Charity Commission website, just explain these are the things that Grace Church stands for and why it benefits wider society. So we did it there, and you can look it up if you want to on the Charity Commission website. But the other time was a conversation with some neighbours of mine in Greenwich who are very lovely, and they're very positive about me being a vicar, and you know, they're very encouraging about the church. And I remember in lockdown, they said, "Oh, how's it going at Grace Church?" What kind of things are you able to do? Do you do the soup kitchens? And I guess you must work with the addicts, do you? Is that the kind of thing you do? And we're really behind that, and good on you. And I said, oh, actually, we don't run a soup kitchen. I mean, it's a good thing. And lots of churches who've got buildings in the middle of communities are a host for that kind of ministry, but we don't have a building, so we don't do a soup kitchen. And addicts ministry, well, we have people struggling with various things, but we don't have a particular addicts. And they just looked kind of a bit confused because they thought, we like you, Andrew, and we think the church does a good thing, but you don't do the things that we expected you to do. So if it's not the soup kitchen and it's not the addicts ministry, like, what is it that you're about? Maybe you're wondering that. What is Grace Church for? What is its ministry for? If you're not aligned with what Grace Church is about, it's going to be very frustrating for you. Like, how long until they start the soup kitchen? Bear with them at the moment because they're in a building, but I hope we can get on with sort of proper church soon. And why don't we have these kind of ministries? And what is going on with us? And I hope that this sermon is going to, not answer it in a way that gets us off the hook, but answers it in a way that helps us understand where we should be going and does challenge us to go in that direction. And it's kind of obvious, isn't it? I put in the introduction that to find the mission of the church, we ought to really understand what is the mission of Jesus. Because whatever Grace Church is about, it ought to be about the same things that Jesus is about. We should want the same for our society that Jesus wanted for society. We should be going about the things that he did. And actually, that confuses people even more. Because you look at this passage and it says, well, it's obvious what Jesus did. He brought alleviation of poverty. He brought liberty to people who had been imprisoned falsely. He healed blind people and did medicine. Grace Church Greenwich is not obviously doing any of those things. So maybe we should really worry. So that's what we're going to talk about today. What is Jesus' mission and what is our mission? And then how can we get behind it? That's the idea. So I've put number one, Jesus' mission is not quite what we expect. And Jesus' mission is not what you understand if you read verse 18 and 19 quickly and you don't think about it enough. If you read it quickly, Jesus' mission is helping the poor, helping those falsely imprisoned, helping those who are disabled with their sight, bringing liberation for those who are oppressed. Now, let me say, all of those things are very, very good. So if you're an optician or you're an eye doctor, then good on you. This is a real help to people. We're fortunate to live in a Western society where you can get glasses just by going, on the NHS, and you can see. That's brilliant. And isn't it brilliant when people campaign on behalf of those who are political prisoners and unjustly locked up? Wasn't it a relief when that woman from Iran was finally released after years and years of being held? This is a good thing. But Jesus' words, sort of superficially read like that, isn't quite what he means. Now, it's very significant, this paragraph. It's significant because it's in the Bible, but it's also significant because it's really shaped a lot of the Western church's approach to mission. And I want to give you a little bit of history over the last century. So in 1965, churches across the whole world got together for a world evangelism conference. And it was held in Berlin. And the main speaker was Billy Graham, the famous evangelist. And basically the idea was to get all the churches together to think, how do we reach the parts of the world that still have not been touched by the gospel of Jesus? It's a great thing to do. So they kind of had a world map, and here are the countries where the church is thriving. Here are the countries we haven't even reached at all. Let's commit together for mission. Significant conference. And the decision on that conference was that mission is very clear. It means to take the message of Jesus' forgiveness of sins and his resurrection from the dead to all the nations of the world. We want to proclaim Christ crucified for forgiveness of sins and his resurrection so now he's Lord and King to everywhere. 1965, pretty uncontroversial. In 1974, they had another convention, this time in Lausanne in Switzerland. And on the basis of this paragraph in Luke's gospel, they broadened the mission. Because they said, look, we're just talking about forgiveness and about the message of Jesus' death and resurrection. But it's clear here in Luke that Jesus thought that his ministry was actually about helping the poor and bringing liberty to the captives. And so we need to broaden it. And at that conference, they decided that rather than only be about proclaiming the gospel, the church's mission should be about proclaiming the gospel and bringing social justice, bringing care for those who are most vulnerable and most oppressed. And famously, they would describe those two things as being like two wings of a bird or two blades of a pair of scissors. You just can't have one without the other. It doesn't work. You know, a one-bladed pair of scissors would not have set Naomi free. You need both blades. And so we need gospel proclamation and we need social justice. And both of those are the church's mission. And then more recently, the conference keeps meeting every few years. And more recently, they now said that there's actually four things that the church is about. So it's about preaching the gospel, and it's about meeting the needs of poverty, and it's about campaigning for justice in places where there's injustice, places like Iran, I guess, in our thoughts at the moment. And it's about care for the creation. So, you know, preventing species becoming extinct, being aware of green issues and so on. So what is the mission of Jesus? What should be the mission of the church? Is it a narrow one about his death and resurrection and the forgiveness of sins? Or is it lots of different things? You know, having an ecological conscience and campaigning and politically, writing letters to your MP or to Amnesty International and trying to alleviate poverty or even eliminate poverty. That charity, Make Poverty History, has lots of Christian backing up. You know, are all of these things the things we should be trying to do? Because surely here in Luke's gospel, Jesus is about all of these kinds of things, isn't he? Well, I want to suggest that actually we misunderstand these words if we don't read them carefully. And I want to argue that actually Jesus has a very narrow definition of mission, but then it comes to be very broad. So actually, if we're thinking, but surely the poor are important, yes, they are, and we'll get to that. Surely oppression is bad. Yes, it is. We'll get to that. But we'll start by saying it begins very narrow. And we need, I put down here two tools. If you're joining us on Wednesday and you're using the little book with the blind man's eyes and or blind woman's eyes on the front and on the back, opened eyes, you'll see that we're introducing some of these kind of principles of how to read the Bible carefully. And I just want to look a bit more closely at these verses. So firstly, I want to look at repetition. Jesus doesn't actually say that he's come to give money to the poor or that he's come to open the prisons. He says he's come to proclaim it. Now, maybe that's a subtle difference, but can you see verse 18? The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovery of sight, the blind, to set liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. Three times Jesus says his ministry is about talking, first and foremost. He's going to say something. So it's not just that he goes and alleviates poverty with a soup kitchen or a hospital or something. First and foremost, he says something about the poor. He says something about the oppressed. And you might think, well, what use is that? You know, if you're just going to, just words, I mean, the last thing somebody's poor needs is just somebody telling them to enjoy a nice meal and then you don't provide it. In fact, later in the Bible, in James, he says that exact point. You know, if someone comes amongst you and they're hungry and you say, oh, be well fed, that is not useful to them. So just mere words, how's that going to help? The other thing we need to notice, not just as a repetition, but also the Old Testament background, the quotation allusion. And this is really the key. Jesus quotes these words from Isaiah, a prophet writing 800 years earlier, and says these words are true today. Today these words have become true. So what was Isaiah promising? Well, what we've got to understand is Isaiah was writing to some people who were poor and oppressed and imprisoned and blind for a very particular reason. People can be enslaved for all kinds of reasons. So they can be enslaved because of people kidnapping them, because that's what happened in the transatlantic slave industry. You know, people would go to Africa and literally kidnap people and force them into slavery, which is an awful thing. But that isn't the kind of slavery that Isaiah is talking about here. You can go into slavery, at least you could in the history, by being in debt and you couldn't pay it off. And so you went to a debtor's prison where you were kind of forced to pay off your debt. But that's not the kind of slavery that Isaiah is talking about here. Isaiah is addressed to people who are slaves for a very particular reason. They're slaves in Babylon, and they went there because God kicked them out the promised land because of their sin. Actually, this keeps happening in the history of the world. Adam and Eve, the first human beings, enjoyed a paradise in Eden, the Garden of Eden, a beautiful place. But then they sinned, they disobeyed God, and he kicked them out. And then later on, Israel got to live in a beautiful place, the land of milk and honey, land of Canaan. And they enjoyed wonderful prosperity there. But then because of their sin, God kicked them out. And this prophecy, Isaiah spoke to people who had been evicted from the promised land and found themselves in captivity in Babylon. It wasn't kind of, oh, poor them. They were enslaved by evil kidnappers, like many slaves are today. It was, look at God's judgment on them. God warned them again and again that if they kept disobeying him, they would be exiled. And yet they wouldn't listen, and they were. They were in Babylon, and they deserved to be there. They were in a prison of their own making, if you like. When it says that they were poor, I mean, yeah, same reason. They were cut off from the prosperity of the promised land because of their sin. When it says they were blind, same reason. I mean, they weren't physically blind, but Isaiah kept speaking about their kind of spiritual blindness. Why is it that they couldn't see the truth of the gospel of God? It's almost like they're blind. God asked the question in Isaiah, who is blind like my servant Israel? You know, they've had this whole history of God's revelation, and yet they're in a place where they don't see what's in front of their face. And instead of trusting in God, they go aside after idols. And instead of living God's way, they start to live the same way as the pagan nations around them. And it's like they're blinded. In fact, there's even a passage that we're going to come to in Isaiah. We're going to see in our midweek groups in Mark's gospel, where God says, well, in that case, you know, be blind. You won't listen. I'll blind you. I'll deafen you so that you can't see or hear anymore. Okay, so let me just recap. This is the prophecy written to people who are poor and oppressed and blind for a very particular reason. Because they disobey God and were thrown into exile. So we're not talking about how God feels about all blind people. Jesus is very compassionate when he meets blind people, and he does physically heal them, amazingly. It's not how does God feel about all poverty or all oppression. It's what is God going to do about these people who deserve to be in exile in Babylon, in a prison of their own making. And here's the extraordinary message. The Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, to proclaim liberty to the captives. Yeah, Isaiah says that there's a day coming when God will go to all the people who've been evicted from the promised land and tell them, God is ready to pardon you and to forgive you. God's had to push you out of his presence, but now he's inviting you back in. You faced his anger and his judgment because of the way you treated God and treated each other. But now he's willing to show you his favor. And it all begins with an announcement, with words, but words from God about a change of relationship. An amazing thing. In fact, Jesus even makes this point even more strongly. Now, I don't know how much you were paying attention when we gave the reading from Isaiah. But actually, the reading from Isaiah is a little bit longer than the reading that Jesus gives in the synagogue. So he actually cuts off the reading mid-sentence, which is quite a shocking thing to do, I think. It's editing out the Bible. Sometimes people do that for really bad reasons. So I remember being in St. Paul's Cathedral once, and they were doing a reading from the book of Romans. And there's a bit that talks about homosexuality and God's plans for marriage. And they just missed that because they thought we don't want to read that in the 21st century. And it was quite shocking. Because I know the beginning of Romans, I noticed, whoa, you've just censored the Bible. That is shocking. I remember going to a crematorium, and one of the favorite readings in funerals is from John's Gospel, John chapter 14, where Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father except through me. And in the crematorium Bible, it said, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. And then there was a big black mark saying, stop reading here. Don't say, no one can come to the Father except through me, because that's not very palatable. So they censored the Bible. It's quite shocking when someone just only quotes half of a verse. But then Jesus does it here. And obviously not because he's trying to censor the Bible, but he's saying something that's quite shocking. If you know how the quote goes, you're like, why has Jesus missed out the second half? This is how it actually goes. In Isaiah, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of the vengeance of our God. Judgment day, the day of God's vengeance, the day of God's anger against sin. And Jesus misses that half the verse out. Now, it's not because Jesus doesn't believe in judgment day. He's going to say a lot about that later on, actually. But he's saying that's not now. Now, today, is the year of the Lord's favor. And Jesus, when he arrived 2,000 years ago, he announced that this is the age where God is willing to have people back into relationship with him. People who got kicked out of the promised land. People who spiritually are blind because they just can't see what should be obvious to them. People whose lives are going down a spiral because of the consequences of rejecting God. He'll have them back, he says. This is the year of the Lord's favor. Judgment day. That's later. We'll deal with that later. But now, for 2,000 years and counting, a day of God's favor, a day of God's salvation. And that is what it's about. That is his ministry. Now, therefore, at Grace Church Greenwich, this should be our narrow focus. We need to proclaim, because this is this amazing period in history, these are the days when God will have anyone back. People who find themselves in a spiritual mess because they've rejected God. People who don't deserve to live in his presence. People who've been like those Israelites back in the time of the exile, kicked out of God's promised land. God will have us back. And he announces favor, salvation, rescue, liberty. It's actually not about primarily physical blindness, not about physical poverty. It's about being spiritually poor. It's not about being political prisoners or just prisoners. I mean, if you read it totally out of context, you know, it wouldn't obviously be good news that Jesus came to announce liberty for the captives, like all of them. Imagine Jesus going to Wormwood Scrubs and just opening all the cells. And, you know, it kind of depends why you're in prison and whether we want to set you free. But it's a particular kind of imprisonment, a spiritual imprisonment. If anyone sins, they are a slave to sin, says Jesus. If the Son sets you free, then you'll be free indeed. That's the kind of liberty Jesus comes to bring. And so when churches say our primary mission is addiction counseling, I would say no. Your primary mission has got to be telling people about forgiveness of sins through Jesus. Our primary mission is to try and make poverty history. Well, I mean, you won't. Jesus said you'll always have the poor amongst us. That's not to be your focus. Rather, any Christian mission must be aligned with Jesus' mission, namely to proclaim God's favor, salvation, spiritual blessings for anyone who would turn back to him. And it's slightly sad, and I won't mention the names, but there's a Christian charity that mainly just does poverty relief. And it's a huge charity. And, you know, it does good stuff. So, you know, it provides clean water and relief in areas of war and food, etc. It's, you know, it does good stuff. But more money is given to that charity than all of the UK charities put together that are about proclaiming the gospel. It's not a bad thing to care about poverty, but it's the distinctively Christian thing to announce this news, forgiveness of sins. And I think that tells me that there's been a lot of mission drift in the church. You know, Christians end up just caring about the same things as the average Greenwich resident. Imagine, you know, I had to ask my neighbors who were not Christians, what do you want from the world, for the world, rather? What would you like to see happen in the world? They would say, I bet you, we want liberty for oppressed people in Iran. We want people who are poor to be able to pay their food bills through the winter. We want better medical care and shorter NHS waiting lists for people who are blind and, you know, have other medical conditions. We want society to be better, to be more just, to be more healthy, to be more prosperous. Yeah, you don't have to be Christian to want that. But only the Christian mission says that's got to start with having a restored relationship with God. Because a lot of the mess we get ourselves into, certainly the mess that they got themselves into in Babylon, was because God kicked us out of his blessings because we turned our back on him. And now Jesus is saying, this is the year when God will have you back. But I wanted to add this little extra point in brackets under point one. And it's this. So he came to bring, to proclaim spiritual liberation rather than physical liberation. And yet, it's a rather lovely thing that spiritually liberated people often bring physical liberation. So I'm not saying that Christians shouldn't care about poverty. And they do, and they always have. Alms for the poor, for those who are the most vulnerable. It's not that Christians shouldn't care about political justice. They do, and they always have. And in fact, the history of Western society, I hope you know this, is really incredibly shaped by Christianity in this regard. So Christians were the first to set up hospitals. If you find a really, really, really old hospital, it would have been set up by Christians in the UK. Christians were the first to set up schools. For everyone, you used to be able to be educated if you were super rich in the past. You'd have a governor or a governess in your private household. But to go to a public school, which in those days meant a school for everyone, I know that's now the old schools that are the private expensive ones. But in the old days, the public schools were exactly that. They were schools for the people who couldn't afford private governors. And they were set up by Christians. They set up the hospitals. They set up the schools. They stopped people going down the mines, you know, the Factory Act that stopped young children being exploited as slave labor came back by the campaign of Christians. The end of slavery in Britain was the result, as you know, of the tireless campaign by William Wilberforce, who was an evangelical Christian. So really, there have been incredible social reforms. And I was very challenged by, I was just looking up in this book, I thought, I'm sure Tom Holland will narrate this well. He's a historian. He's written this book, which I very much recommend, about the effect of Christianity on Western civilization. He's actually not a Christian, amazingly, or it wasn't when he wrote the book anyway. But he explains how Christians bring this revolution. So he's comparing Rome, ancient Rome, in the days of Augustus, to modern day, to later London in the 18th century or 19th century. So the Britain of Darwin's day could boast what no one in Augustus Rome had ever thought to sponsor: campaigns to redeem the poor, the exploited, the diseased. Darwin himself, the grandson of two abolitionists, knew well the impulse from which these sprang. The cause of social reform was Christian through and through. We build asylums for the imbecile, the maimed, the sick. We institute poor laws. Our medical men exert their utmost skill to save the life of everyone to the last moment. And then this is the rather chilling thing. Darwin, as he was moving further and further away from his Christian beginnings, he began to wonder whether this was a bit of a mistake, actually. No one who's attended to the breeding of domestic animals will doubt that this must be highly injurious to the race of man. Now, this is a very chilling thing. What Darwin is saying is because his view of that we're here by random chance and by natural selection, it weeds out the fittest to survive. Surely it's quite a good thing that the weakest die and those who are poor and diseased are taken out of the population. And yet here's these Christians looking after the vulnerable people. And Darwin thinks that could be a bit of a mistake. Wouldn't it be better just to let those who are going to, you know, let those die who are going to die and let those be strong who are going to be strong, which is quite a chilling thing. But I wanted to read that to you so you can see that not everybody believes in the care for the poor and the liberty to the captives. And it is a distinctively Christian thing. Now, let me put the two together. I'm saying it's not the mission of the church to alleviate poverty and to end injustice and to bring better healthcare. But it shouldn't surprise us that people forgiven by God, brought back into a relationship with God, do those exact things. Do you see what we're trying to say here? There's a narrow focus that leads to a broad focus. The mission of Jesus is all about, exclusively about, spiritual liberation, which he proclaims. But the effects of that on human beings is to transform them to care about the poor, the blind, the injured, the injustice, everywhere they find it. And therefore, that should be our model at Grace Church Greenwich, exclusively focused on the gospel of forgiveness of sins through Jesus' death and resurrection. That's what we're about. Although as people in this church are transformed by the love of Jesus, it wouldn't surprise me at all to discover that you're involved in various ways caring for your neighbours and that you're politically engaged with Christian values or that you're involved in various projects to do good wherever you can in the wider society. It's a narrow gospel of spiritual liberation that leads to a whole transformed world. That is the mission of Jesus. But it's not quite what we expect. That's the reason I think a lot of people get angry with Jesus, isn't it? You know, how come there's still so much suffering in the world 2,000 years later? Jesus, this is your fault. You were supposed to end poverty, but people are still poor. You were supposed to end sickness, but people are still sick. People get very angry with God, don't they, when they're ill or when people die. God, you owed us more than this. You were supposed to stop bad things happening, and you didn't. And people are cross with when God allows political tyranny, like in Russia or like in Iran. Lord, you're supposed to be against this, and you haven't done it. And Jesus says, yeah, no, that wasn't my agenda. In the short term, in the end, I'll fix the whole world. But my means of fixing the world was to preach this message of forgiveness and of the possibility of friendship with God. And I've been doing that for 2,000 years, and it's working. It depends where you look, doesn't it? If you do the poverty index or the oppression index, or do you do the forgiveness index? That's what Jesus is about. But it's not what people expect, and it's not what they want him to do. And that brings us much more quickly to our second point. You'll notice that there's a great change in the mood of the crowd on this day in church or in the synagogue in the first century. I want you to see if you can trace it with me, how it goes. So it's a normal Saturday synagogue meeting. They meet on Saturdays, not Sundays. And Jesus is there. And he does the reading, a bit like Betty did. And he picks up and actually reads the same words Betty did. But then he ends in a different way to how Betty ended the reading. She didn't say, and this has become true today. And that's the bombshell. You know, Jesus is saying, you know, this ancient prophecy of Isaiah, it is now fulfilled as I read it. You know, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to proclaim, and I'm doing it now, and now is the fulfillment. And they're like, oh, you know, shock. And they're kind of pretty chuffed as well. Not only are they're shocked, but they're also delighted. What you've come to bring good news to the poor. So all the poor people here are suddenly going to find themselves rich. Great. And liberty of sight to the blind. So all the people who are sick here or disabled here are suddenly going to be healed. Brilliant. You know, this is great. We're a bit shocked, but hooray. We've got our very own personal genie. Jesus, solve our problems. This problem here, the society could do with this, and we could do with some political liberty, actually, because the Romans are still occupying our streets. So you could help us in that way as well with an uprising. Jesus, are you ready for that? And Jesus won't do it. In fact, he won't do anything in Nazareth, his hometown. In fact, he says to them, verse 23, doubtless you'll quote to me this proverb, physician, heal yourself. What we've heard you did in Capernaum, do here. In Capernaum, Jesus had done some amazing miracles. Do some amazing miracles here. And Jesus goes, No, that's not what I'm about. And the same people who had marveled and spoke well of him in verse 22 want to kill him in verse 29. That's quite a change, isn't it? In the space of seven verses, they go from praise to murderous intent. Why? Because Jesus refuses to do what they want him to do. He won't be their genie. He won't be harnessed by their agenda. People are always trying to hijack Jesus to do the things that they want him to do. You know, Jesus, the champion of my green agenda, if I have a green agenda. Jesus, the champion of my political campaign, if I have a political campaign. But we won't listen to what Jesus himself says he's about. I've come to bring forgiveness and a relationship with God. We don't want that, Jesus. We don't want those spiritual things. We want physical stuff now. No, says Jesus. And they get very, very angry. And there's a real irony here, because then Jesus goes on with these two illustrations from the Old Testament of how he ended up helping very unexpected people who were humble enough to admit they had a spiritual problem, even as the religious people just only could see their physical problems. So in the times of Elijah and Elisha, there was great problems in Israel. There was a lack of food, there was poverty. Actually, there was poverty because of people turning their back on God, turns out. And there was sickness. People had all sorts of diseases. And Elijah and Elisha came along, but they wouldn't help the Israelites because the Israelites didn't want to know. The religious people didn't realize they had a spiritual problem. So Elijah ended up going to a Sidonian woman and helping her. And Elisha ended up going to a Syrian general, actually an enemy nation, and helping him. And these people, Naaman and the widow in Elijah's day, they were humble enough to say, please help me spiritually. I want to follow your God. Even as the religious people just constantly wanted to hijack them for another agenda. We'll see that as we go through Luke's gospel, that Jesus keeps offering the same thing. And a lot of people say that, Jesus, this just doesn't match our expectations. It's not our agenda. You know, I come to church to be happy and you're not always making me happy. I come to church for a spiritual feel-good factor, and sometimes you say things that do not make me feel good, Jesus. I'm not up for this. I come to church to find happiness, to find health, and I've been really sick this last year, Jesus. I come to this church to find friendship, and I feel I'm very lonely, Jesus. Jesus, if you won't dance to my tune, I'm really angry with you. And Jesus says, look, you've got to understand that my mission is something much more profound than that. It's about fixing your relationship with God, the God that you turned your back on, that who's had to kick you out of a relationship with him. He's offering favor. Judgment Day, that will come, but it's coming later. I've delayed it. But now the time of forgiveness, of restored relationship with God. And as your relationship with God is restored, some of those other things are going to follow. Some of them in this life. There will be healing sometimes. There will be relational restoration sometimes. There will be Christians who care about justice more. But those are the kind of side effects, the consequences. But the mission is a narrow one, about proclaiming something to people who are in prison for a very particular reason. Anyone who sins is a slave to sin. But if the Son sets you free, you will be truly free. Jesus says, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me. He's anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor, liberty to the captives, recovery of sight to the blind, liberty those who are oppressed by sin, who've got themselves into a mess because of turning away from God, but now to proclaim to them the year of the Lord's favor." And some people get very angry when Jesus won't dance to their tune. Come on, Jesus. And so he goes elsewhere and he finds people who want the forgiveness that he's offering. We're going to take a moment to pause. I've got a couple of questions for afterwards, and I hope that we will reflect on these. What should be the mission of Grace Church? You know, how should this shape what we give our time, resources, money to? I'm not saying, oh, great, we pat ourselves on the back, we do this. It's actually quite challenging, isn't it? What are we doing to get the gospel of Jesus out to Greenwich? And what should be your mission as you try and align with his? So we'll take a pause now and then prayers, and then maybe we can discuss these very things downstairs at the end.